Blog Talk Radio.
Who's benefiting from these wars? These wars of destruction? Bombs dropping on Mother Earth, killing the people, innocent people? We have to do better than this.
Tineska, Akwani, greetings and peace in the language of the Wampanoag people. My name is Penny Gamble Williams.
And here with her on this beautiful day, Thunder Williams.
Yes, and it is a beautiful day, a day to transform our lives, you know, help each other reach out and do something.
Yes, and we're going to reach out today, and we're going to reach out far and high for Haiti. And our topic today, Haiti, robbed, not poor, but robbed. And we have a special guest waiting to join us at the mic. And Penny, that person is?
That person is Paul Pumphreys, and we are so happy to have him. And we are going to be speaking with him in a little while.
That's right. Paul Pumphrey is a human rights activist, labor organizer, social justice advocate, and a person who has lived and worked in Haiti over the years and has an intimate knowledge of Haiti and its people. And we're going to talk with him about the real story, get the real scoop of what's happening in Haiti and not just the information that we have been sort of force-fed, the disinformation even, according to many, that we have been fed on the national and international news media. So thank you for joining us. And we want to encourage you to make comments in the chat room. And, you know, you can certainly call us at the call-in number, 646-716-4294. And as per usual, we begin our Indigenous Circle with a prayer.
Kitanit, Numakini Witamog, Oki. Numakani Witamog, Okamas, Nupashat, Numakani Witamog, Wutachi Kriyasum, Nupawas, Numakani Witamog, Sabat Nuayim, Numakani Witamog, E Utnu Sheik Aki, Wampanayo, Solanayo, Patanayo, Manamayo. Great Spirit, I offer this tobacco, Aki, Mother Earth, I offer this tobacco. Grandmother Moon, I offer this tobacco, Grandfather Sun, I offer this tobacco. I offer this tobacco to the four directions, to the east, to the south, to the west, to the north. For that, I say, Katabatash. Thank you.
Yes, Tabatni, Aho, and Matakwa Austin, we are all related. And we want to take this opportunity to bring our special guest to the mic. Welcome to the Talking Feather Radio, Paul Pumphrey.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, sir. And if you could just speak up just a bit, that would be great.
Okay, is this better?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, we can hear you much clearer. Well, Paul, you know, we have a special topic today, a topic that I know, and a place. We're going to be talking about a place that's near and dear to your heart. And speaking of hearts, I know our hearts are all wrenched and broken, in a manner of speaking, to just watch the devastation that has taken place. And I just want to set a little context for our topic, because as we all know, on the 12th of January this year, 2010, a devastating catastrophe struck Haiti. And any large city in the world would have suffered extensive damage from an earthquake on the scale of that which ravaged Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas of Haiti's capital city on that Tuesday afternoon. But it is no accident that so much of Port-au-Prince now looks like a war zone. I mean, how did this happen? And how it happened, facts will reveal that a lot of this is a thoroughly man-made outcome of a long and ugly historical sequence, and that's what we are going to be exploring today. And, you know, Haiti is routinely described as the, quote, poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, close quote. But this poverty is a direct legacy of perhaps the most brutal system of colonial exploitation in world history, compounded by decades of systemic post-colonial oppression. And so our title, Haiti Robbed, Not Poor, and we're certainly going to thoroughly explore that, and as we said, invite you to join us here in the chat room. If you are listening live, please sign in and ask questions, make comments, and feel free to call us. And that number again is 646-716-4294.
Paul Pumphrey, we are so happy to have you here on the Talking Feather. And through your work as a human rights activist, labor organizer, social justice advocate, you have become to know the Haitian people and the country. Tell us your story of how you came to know the people of Haiti.
Well, back in 1975, I was a co-founder of an organization known as the Anti-Apartheid Movement USA. And at that point, most people here in the United States didn't even know what the word apartheid meant. And as I spoke about apartheid in South Africa in the Washington metropolitan area, a number of the Haitians who heard me talk about apartheid began to share with me their story about what was going on in their homeland. And I began to become involved in paying attention to what was happening in Haiti back in that time of 1975, and began to feel a connection to Haiti itself. And skip ahead 20 years, I was invited by the founder of the largest peasant movement in Haiti to come down and visit Haiti. And so June, the first week of June in 1995, I actually made my first visit to Haiti. Now, many of the friends that I had met in Washington from the Haitian community had gone back to Haiti to participate in their struggle back in the early 80s, and so I had not seen them for a number of years. And one of the first things I did when I got on ground there was to inquire if they were still even alive, because they had gone through a military coup, and they had gone through, after Duvalier was taken out, the military took over the government for a number of years. And I was amazed to find that not only was I able to find them, but that they actually were holding top posts in the upcoming national elections in Haiti. And so I was able to hit the ground kind of running, and getting the opportunity to meet a number of the grassroots organizations throughout the country, because these people who I knew from Washington, D.C., were able to introduce me to different movement leaders and different movement organizations throughout Haiti. And so from that point on, I was able to not only work directly with the organization they were working with, but work with organizations outside of Port-au-Prince, in the countryside, in the north, in the south, in the east, as well as in the west. And that's what gave me an opportunity to really get an overview of what was really happening in Haiti itself and to get a good feeling of, as to the direction of the grassroots organizations and what they were trying to do in bringing about change in Haiti. And I will have to say, my experience taught me that Haiti was a very well-organized country. And that probably helps explain why the United States consistently bring their military into Haiti, because they find it quite difficult to run Haiti from afar, because the grassroots organizations reorganize and reconstitute themselves and challenge, as they did back in the 1700s and 1800s, against the French, the British, and the Spaniards. That Haitians have a very strong spirit, and that spirit of theirs is determined that they will be free, and they will fight with very little tools to work with against an enemy that have very sophisticated tools, whether that enemy is the Valle or whether that enemy happens to be in the format of the United States government. They will challenge anybody that's just going to try to come in and rule the, and overrule them.
Yes, well, you know, Paul Pumphrey, we have on a prior show several weeks ago talked about that history of this very self-sufficient, very resilient nation. And just to briefly reiterate, you know, Haiti formally renounced its colonial bond with France in January 1807 as a result of the only successful slave rebellion in world history. And the country's longevity as an independent nation in the Western Hemisphere is second only to that of the United States. But, you know, over this span of almost two centuries, the country seems to have never known a period free from tyranny, repression, political conflict, racial animosity, and economic hardship. So, you know, it's a very complex, in a sense, history when you look at Haiti, this first black republic in modern times that sprang directly to self-governance from French colonialism. And they had a system there that had a profound impact on the nations. And we looked at before that Haiti's colonial origins showed that a illiterate, impoverished majority, so to speak, could be ruled by a repressive elite. And the slaveholding system had established the efficacy of violence and coercion in controlling others. And the racial prejudice inherent in this colonial system survived under the Black Republic. And so today, we have a situation, as you said, Paul Pumphrey, where the enemies, if we so to speak, of Haiti, or the people that have done such damage to Haiti, have not only been external, but internal as well.
One thing, though, I think is quite clear, is that the locals could not have stayed in power as long as they did if it wasn't that they had such a great deal of help from the external forces.
Mm.
And so they often aligned themselves with external forces as a means to stay in power. But as capitalism developed even more, the external forces wanted to move into where they would dominate and control it completely. And when it went from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy, then it became a split between the external business class and the internal business class of Haiti.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a period in time. I mean, we're going to, throughout this, we're going to talk about this extraordinary resilience of the Haitian masses, the Haitian people. You know, notwithstanding the oppression, the racial animosity, and the turmoil that has so often been the legacy, so to speak, in Haiti, the people, as we see described today, even by those who have gone, especially by those who have gone to sort of give aid and rescue and comfort to those afflicted by the earthquake, keep describing them as a beautiful people, a kind people, a gentle people, under the most severe of circumstances that I can't even imagine living through. They have exercised a restraint that I think is just unimaginable in my mind. I mean, just but be that as it may, we're going to talk about those traditions and those values of the Haitian people as we proceed to sort of tap into this beautiful place that has been misaligned and denigrated and called so many things, the poorest country, the most chaotic, et cetera, and so forth. But, Paul, let's go back to a period in time around 1915. So when we talk about the 1915 United States invasion and occupation of Haiti that lasted 19 years through 1934, if we could, and highlight some events that were significant in shaping the outcomes that we see in Haiti today, what would those events be? What are some of the events that demonstrate that the plight of Haiti as we see it today?
Well, one of the things was that the United States sent their Marines into Haiti, very similar and almost to the way that the response was to this hurricane, I mean to this earthquake, was that in fact that again the United States has sent their Marines into Haiti. But in 1915, they came in, and they really had to work very hard to try to find a Haitian that had any kind of political position to agree to say that they were inviting the U.S. military there. The United States really worked hard to get a cover to justify that they were not just bogarting their way into the country as they really were. But what happened was that this was something that had gone on in other islands in the Caribbean, wherein after the Spanish War, a number of business people who had large plantations took advantage of the Caribbean countries in setting up large tracts of land for sugar production and other types of tropical food production to be shipped from that Caribbean island back into the United States. They did it in Cuba, they did it in Puerto Rico, they did it in Dominican Republic, and now in 1915 they were getting ready to implement the same thing in Haiti, which I find quite interesting. One of the only railroad that was ever built and operated in Haiti was put there to move sugarcane from one part of the country to the sugar mill, from the fields to the sugar mill. And just to give an idea that when people often try to describe the United States being involved in Haiti during that period of time from 1915 to 1934, it was there to help the people of Haiti, but the investment was put in there to help U.S. businesses take over Haiti and to make huge sums of money while subjugating the people of Haiti to work very cheaply, much cheaper than their sharecroppers were working here in the United States. And so that was kind of the approach in the beginning of the first couple of years, the first few years in the invasion in 1915. As the years went on, you began to find that where Haiti up to that point it had a lot of small farmers, people were gathered from all over the island to come in and forced to work on these large tracts of land. And so you found a situation where instead of people working as individuals doing their own thing in agriculture, they were now forced in as forced laborers. And it allowed the Haitian community again to begin to organize and to put pressure on those who were oppressing them. Now, one other thing the U.S. government did during that period of time was create a national army for Haiti. And this national army was created in such a way that its leadership were beholding not to the government of Haiti, but beholding to the U.S. government. And this became quite important to look at in the history of Haiti, because you found that from time to time, the Haitian army would be called out to overthrow governments that the United States, for one reason or another, fell in disfavor with. And as this process went on, you began to see how people began to really develop techniques of organizing, similar to the techniques that they had when they fought against the French and Napoleon back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. They were reorganizing their structure, because when the Marines first came into Haiti, the Haitians themselves organized into armed bands, in which they called them cockles at that time. They fought against the U.S. military, and a number of U.S. soldiers were killed as the Haitians fought back from being taken over by the U.S. military. Obviously, the United States had a much bigger ability to make weapons and had much more sophisticated weapons. And after about 10 years or so, they were able to pretty much neutralize the armed struggle against them, but the demonstrations and other things in Haiti continued to go on until we got by the year of 1934. This is, as you well know, was 4 or 5 years after the Great Depression here in the United States. The United States came to the conclusion it would be better for them to take their troops out of Haiti for more of economic reasons, and the cause it was to maintain them there. And they felt more confident, as they're trying to do right now in Iraq, to have the army of Haiti that they created take over the role of their own troops. And we see the parallel.
Yes.
And this policy of going into a country, taking over the country, training the police department, training the military, and then have them do their dirty work for them once they leave.
I want to go to this period again and just, if we can just put a pause here and stay here just for a minute, this period of the United States occupation, 1915 to 1934, we see why this devastation in Haiti was so great, why Haiti with this earthquake looks like a war zone. You know, you had similar catastrophes hit Cuba, but somehow Cuba had an infrastructure, political, economic, physical, that was able to withstand it, whereas Haiti's crumbled, literally. You know, so we go back to 1915 to set a framework. The representatives from the United States came in and they wielded veto power over all government decisions in Haiti. And the Marine Corps commanders served as administrators in all the provinces. And there was a treaty passed by the Haitian legislature in November of 1915 that granted authority to the United States. And that allowed Washington to assume complete control of Haiti's finances and gave the United States sole authority over the appointment of advisors and receivers. And it also gave the United States total responsibility for establishing and running public health and public works programs and supervising routine government affairs. So it was really a sort of a complete takeover 90 years ago when Professor Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States, led this invasion and occupation. And Paul Pumphrey, you know, there was one thing that stood out, and I want to quote from an excerpt from an article that was written by a Jamaican journalist, John Maxwell, in the Jamaican Observer on January 17, 2010, and it's in, it appears at InfoWars, InfoWars.com, and he talks about the Americans going into Haiti, and he says that the Americans decided to invade Haiti to collect debts owed by Haiti to Citibank, because as we know, the French had demanded that Haitians pay France an amount equivalent to 90% of the entire Haitian budget for the foreseeable future, because they said You were our property. You freed yourself, and now you must pay reparations. So not only did they win their freedom in blood, but they had to pay for their freedom in gold. And there was a particular general whose insight into this was quite telling. His name is General Smiley Butler. Smiley Butler, the only American soldier to have twice won the Congressional Medal of Honor, describes his role in the United States Army, and I quote, he says, "I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interest in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues. I helped in the raping of a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long." And General Butler goes on to say, quote, "I suspected that I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I'm sure of it. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of higher ups." This is typical in the military service. And then Butler concluded his statements by comparing himself unfavorably to Al Capone. He said that his official racketeering made Capone look like an amateur. And Paul, I think that says a lot about the intention, the mentality of the Western forces, the United States, the European allies that were preying upon Haiti at the time, in this particular period, 1915 to 1934 and beyond.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that the United States has had a track record that has been fairly bloody and quite exploitive against the people of Haiti. And if we just look at some of the tactics and some of the deeds in which the United States have used against the people of Haiti, I would say that most people in the United States would be ashamed of the history of the U.S. government in Haiti. One point I wanted to bring up also was at the time that Haiti was a colony of France, it produced twice the wealth for France as all of the other colonies in this hemisphere were producing for their colonial states. And this is why Napoleon fought so hard to try to keep control over Haiti and to keep Haiti as part of its colonies. Because if Haiti was so poor, how was it able to produce so much wealth for France? And again, that goes back to your topic for this evening, as to whether or not Haiti is poor or whether or not it is robbed.
Yes.
The other thing I would say is that as the U.S. moved and really took over the country, it kind of balkanized the country. And again, it gives a good example of what they say they want to do in Iraq as well as what they're saying they want to do in Afghanistan. The U.S., when they pulled out or got ready to pull out in 1934, developed an elite class in Haiti, and pretty much left them in charge almost as if they were the middlemen, in which they were the kind of the straw bosses or the middlemen of the society, and still the wealth was generated. A great deal of that wealth ended up in the hands of the U.S. businesses, only they didn't have to, quote-unquote, get their hands dirty. They could stay in the United States and still have the raw products sent to them in the United States, where they would then sell it and make a huge profit. So you had a situation where not only did they leave the military there to control the direction of the government, but they also developed a number of other institutions, businesses in the large agriculture sector. They developed other types of industries in the country. And it was all designed really to give the money to the U.S. businesses that had set it up with the help of the U.S. government. And I think that as a citizen of the United States, as a person who was born in this country, we should be asking ourselves, should our government, should the government of the United States be functioning in this way? Or, in fact, is this the kind of way that we would want to be represented in other parts of the world? For myself, I say clearly, this is not the way that I feel that the government of a country that I live in should function against other people around the world, especially the way they've treated the people in Haiti.
Yes, well, I would certainly agree. And, you know, we have to point out that the United States is not alone in its capitalist, imperialist greed for trying to tap into Haiti's human capital as a captive labor force and its natural resources. You know, the French and the British had a deep interest in Haiti, as did the German community. And, you know, when we go back to that time period, a small German community in Haiti of approximately 200 there were in 1910, it's reported that they wielded a disproportionate amount of economic power, and they controlled 80% of the country's international commerce, and they owned and operated utilities throughout Haiti and in the north and the south. And so, you know, and that was, as some historians report, part of the reason for the 1915 invasion by the United States, because the United States, were becoming quite concerned that Berlin was setting up a German naval fleet and trying to base it strategically in this region. And of course, as you know, Paul, the Monroe Doctrine that opposed European intervention in the Western Hemisphere, and the Roosevelt Corollary, where the United States assumed full responsibility for any direct intervention by European countries in Latin America, came into play, and we wanted Haiti for ourselves. It was quite clear, both to collect that debt Citibank owed and to control that neighbor right at our doorstep. And today, I think, as we move forward with this discussion, we can show that we once again are militarizing Haiti because of that same desire to take control.
Well, you know, Paul, I'd like to say this. The grassroots organizations who, you know, have been pretty fed up with all of the control of outsiders and even some of the corruption that has happened within their government. And, you know, they are the ones that decide to rise up. They're not just sitting back waiting for someone to help, like what we see on the front page of the newspaper, the Washington Post, saying, you know, please, you know, military, please, thank you, take over. So can you talk about some specific things that some of the grassroots organizations have done in the past and what they are planning to do to get back some of their semblance of independence?
Yes, as agriculture began to be more mechanized, more and more of the U.S. agriculture was being done here in the United States, and there was less and less need for them to go outside the borders. And so the large plantations and things that had been established in Haiti and other countries tend to begin to disappear a little bit, and you begin to find that the workers, the small farmers, begin to grow. And Haiti was was a good example of that. What you then found was that because the United States still felt the need of controlling the people of Haiti, they used the military of Haiti to really try to keep people in line and to keep people accepting living on a much lower standard than they were willing to live under. And this caused for a lot of conflict between the different governments that the United States, that followed the United States invasion in Haiti and still seemed to be beholden to the will of the United States against the people of Haiti themselves. And so as the technology developed, you begin to start seeing that the large plantations were being replaced by items such as factories. In fact, in 1973, Richard Nixon began to put a lot of pressure on Baby Doc to allow for large international businesses to move in on Haiti and take advantage of Haiti's cheap labor and skilled labor to make products that would mainly be sold back here in the United States. And there was an agreement signed between Baby Doc and Nelson Rockefeller, who happened to be the vice president at that time under Richard Nixon. And the game plan was to bring in these large businesses, set up economic tax-free zones, enterprise zones, where the state would have to basically build the buildings and build the infrastructure for the business, those factories to operate from, out of their own treasury or out of loans that the state would take out, and that basically these foreign companies would come in, move into these buildings already built, set up their factories, and begin to make their products using, taking advantage of the cheap labor that was in Haiti, where they could then send the products back into the United States and sell the products at the same type of price they were selling the products when it was making it in the United States, even though the labor cost was much, much less and they didn't have to pay taxes. This began to create a lot of friction between the people working in the city and those factories, as well as the grassroots organizations that were working out in the countryside of Haiti. And they began to put pressure on the Duvalier regime. Now, one thing was clear was that when Papa Doc came into power, Papa Doc was more of a nationalist, and he basically took the position that if someone was going to exploit Haiti, then it needs to be a Haitian and not that of a foreigner. And so during his administration, it went from 1957 to 1971, you found a number of Haitian factories being developed inside of Haiti where they were making certain products and exporting into places like the United States. But when 73 came rolling around, many of those factories were pretty much pushed aside because those factories paid some taxes, when these new factories coming in from outside were paying no taxes whatsoever. And so there became a competition between the international business class and the Haitian national business class as to which one will have the advantage of exploiting the grassroots workers inside the country. And in 73, it pretty much meant that the international business class won that battle. And so you begin to find more and more factories coming into Haiti and taking advantage of its cheap labor. As they begin to come into Haiti, you begin to find more and more people also getting organized. Now, as the small farmers were organizing out in the countryside, another thing became clear, and that was that they were being very effective in putting pressure on the Duvalier regime. This effort really pushed the United States into a position of trying to look at a way of how to dismantle the peasantry and their organization. One of the biggest moneymakers for those peasant families was the Creole pig. This was not your typical pig. This was a pig usually black and could be pretty much allowed to graze almost like a cow would graze in the field and get fat all on its own. So you end up having the people who owned these Creole pigs. They found out that they were very easy to maintain. At the same time, when they were mature, these pigs sold for around $300. Well, the U.S., in an effort to try to weaken the peasant movement back in the 70s, I mean the 80s, They literally came up with this idea where there was supposed to be this strange African swine disease that was located in the Dominican Republic. And lo and behold, they came up with a policy that with, the way they resolved that problem was to kill every pig across the border in Haiti. And so you have almost, in a matter of a couple of months, families that had so greatly depended upon the wealth, the income that they could make off of selling a Creole pig, were now put back into abject poverty because of their Creole pigs being destroyed and they not being able to take advantage of the Creole pig as kind of a money bank to help them pay for doctor bills, send the kids to school, and other types of things that they may want to do. And this really led, again, to people it weakened the movement a little bit, but at the same time, what it did was it created such an economic crisis in the countryside, which made up almost two-thirds of the population of Haiti back in that time, to move half of that population out of the countryside and into the cities, which mostly were bordered along the coastline of Haiti. And this move actually was able to help the peasantry gel into very strong organizations. And that those organizations, many of those organizations still exist today. And as the people, many of the peasantry moved into the city, they created new organizations or affiliated organizations even in the cities of Port-au-Prince, Cape Haitien, and other cities that they moved to. So rather than destroy the peasant movement by killing off the pigs, they actually allowed the peasant movement to develop itself in many other parts of Haiti as well as in the cities themselves of Haiti.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, you know, as we placed this, I think all of this was going on during Jean-Claude Duvalier's baby docks reign after his, father was overthrown, so to speak, but we're talking here about 1978 in this time period when this African swine fever.
No, it was actually in the 80s. It was
okay,
in the 80s when this happened.
And
when it did happen, the point was that the United States was the one that imposed it upon the government of Haiti when it first made the suggestion to the government of Haiti to do it. Baby Doc recognized that it would be very unpopular in the country, and he pretty much refused to do it. But the U.S., as it always has in the past, began to apply pressure, and then the military and the police of National Police of Haiti then went on and implemented the actual program of killing off these pigs.
Yes,
a number of the farmers, in an effort to try to protect their pigs because it economically means such a great deal to them,
mm-hmm.
Were killed in the process because if they did not willingly give up their pigs, the army often either beat people or killed them.
Right, and we have quite a few great discussions going on in the chat room, and someone accurately pointed out that Papa Doc died in office and designated his son. I think that was sometime around 1971, perhaps, and he designated his son.
Yes, it was in May of 1971.
Yeah, Jean-Claude Duvalier as Haiti's new leader. But let's go back here, because I want to pick up on some of the conversation going on in the chat room, because it's almost like Haiti and the peasantry and the masses of people are between a rock and a hard place. It's like, you know, they have external forces that have this insatiable imperialist appetite for their wealth, their human capital, their captive labor, cheap labor, resources, et cetera, and so forth. And then they have these corrupt officials. I think there was something like in this period of that we're talking about in the 1900s and whatnot, there were like 22 different leaders that were overthrown, killed, dismembered, assassinated. So where are we here? Because many people look at Haiti and say, well, who's to blame, so to speak? Because, and also some of the comments in the chat room are talking about the fact that that the peasantry have nothing. It's like Haitians have no nothing. They import everything. They have no resources. So where are we going, and how did this happen? I mean, again...
Well, when they kill the pigs off, and over half of the countryside population moved into the cities,
mm-hmm.
you ended up having a number of things happen. One, the state itself lost revenue that they used to gain in their tax programs. And so you found that the roads and things on that line were not fixed. And by them not being fixed, it made it very, very difficult because Haiti is a country full of mountains. And it became very difficult to move food from the countryside to the cities. This meant then that the U.S. then took advantage of that because through provisions they put in loans agreements with the government of Haiti, the United States began to import food into Haiti, and the Haitian government was not allowed to tax that food that was being imported. This is a very typical tactic that the United States employs around the world amongst underdeveloped countries or underdeveloped countries. The result of that was that the Haitian farmers themselves cut back on their production of food because they had no market to sell to. And you ended up with a situation where most of the cities of Haiti are located along the shoreline because this is very typical of a former colonial state. And that is where the colonial power wants to really export the goods and the wealth of that state to their own state. And so you find that the bigger cities are located where there can be ports, seaports. And Haiti was no exception to that rule. And so you found that the United States was able to import rice and other types of products through those ports and sell them in the United States. I mean, sell them in Haiti. Now, if Haiti was so poor, one must ask the question, how is it able to buy so much food from the United States? Obviously, what the situation is that Haiti is constantly being robbed by the United States, as many other countries throughout the Caribbean and other parts of the world are being robbed. And that they're, rather than call it for what it is, they redefine it as basically describing these countries as being poor, rather than the fact that these countries are very much being robbed.
Mm. Let's talk about some of this robbery and be specific. I'm sorry, Penny, you had a point that you wanted to make.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, I mean, there was a point in time when Haiti imported or exported their coffee and their rice. And the fact that, they have the capabilities to do this, but they are actually being prevented from doing this. I mean, every step of the way, even if they try. So, you know, I just wanted to reiterate that because it's just like sometimes hard to wrap your mind around that.
Yeah.
People are capable. They are capable of doing it, but they keep getting pushed back.
Let's go, if we could, Paul, to some of the more recent times with these structural, what do they call them, SAPs, structural adjustment programs, mm-hmm. I think you were alluding to, and some of the people that we think are heroes, I won't say heroes is a bad word, but some of the people we think upon favorably, we see, for example, Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, doing some things, and we say, oh my God, this is good. I mean, they need to get people like Jim. I heard on TV, we need to get people like Jimmy Carter in Haiti that can do something down there to bring about a change. Some people were upset that they saw President Bill Clinton standing next to Baby Bush, or former President Bush, and what are these two vultures doing standing on the fence, so to speak. So talk to us about some of the policies that we may not be aware of that were implemented during the sweatshops of the Carter and Clinton administration and other things that happened there.
Well, there was a lot of pressure being put on the United States because the United States had put itself out of the world as the champion of democracy. And people begin to question the United States and say, well, if you're such a champion of democracy, why is there such a lack of democracy in Haiti where you're doing a lot of business? And the United States was pretty much forced into then trying to clean up its image. And the way they went about doing that was they would claim much larger numbers than actually got released out of jail, because many people during that time of the 70s and early 80s disappeared. I mean, literally disappeared. You know, they were on the streets one day, and next day the family didn't know where they were, and no one seemed to know where they were. What I later found out, that many of these people who had disappeared ended up in Haitian jails, Haitian political jails. And so this created somewhat of an embarrassment to the United States. And as a result, Jimmy Carter made this so-called appeal for Baby Dot to actually release a number of the political prisoners that had been taken to jail. Now, one of the things that happened also is that even though he claimed that he released so many thousands of people out of jail, the actual number was maybe 100 or so that were released. I remember one gentleman who was released, and he was in such bad shape that they literally took him to the hospital for 3 days to try to revive him before they could actually let the public see him as a prisoner of one of the jails in the jail system of Haiti. And even at that, people were shocked to see how poorly his health seemed to be. In fact, his health never got to be 100% after his release from jail. And he described to me what it was like being in jail. This is back in the 1970s. I believe it was about 1976 or 78. He said when he got released from jail, when he got picked up, he was driving down the road, cars cut him off, and he got out of the car, got him, took him out of his car, and threw him in the trunk of a car, and the car sped off. The next thing he know, he's taken to a jail cell. The jail cell was so small for the amount of people in the jail cell that they literally had to take turns in lying down to go to sleep because there wasn't enough room on the floor to sleep. Because he was a political leader, some of the other people that were in jail recognized who he was. And he said that literally there were people that gave him a great deal of support, which he credited them, and helping him to be able to stay alive while he was in jail. He said the first year he was in jail, there were 96 prisoners in that jail with him. By the end of that year, there were only 25 who, of that 96, that were still alive. The second
incredible.
Year, I'm sorry?
Just incredible. Yeah.
Yes. The second year he was in that jail, he said that there was 125 people, even more of the political prisoners were in the jail. And by the end of that year, he said that there were, out of the 125, that there were like something like 30 who survived. And so it was quite clear that it was very, very brutal conditions in which they were put into and living and, you know, staying in the jail system there in Haiti.
Well, you know,
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. No, go right ahead.
All right, so that's just some of the examples, and the United States is aware of that. Hold on a second, I need to change mics.
Okay, what we're going to do here, Paul, what we're going to do here, this might be a good time for us to take a little musical interlude, and we have some music. I think we can all take a little break, rest the minds for a minute, and we invite you to stay tuned. In the chat room, we have a caller on the line, and we see you at area code 580. And we're going to take your call as soon as we come back from a very short break. Stay around, folks. We'll be right back.
are living in America. Take a look at Haiti and see my people are suffering. Remember this, I've had a chance to make it better. Locule nage mes amis, I am a Haitian living in America. Take a look at Haiti and see my people are suffering. Remember this, I've had a chance to make it better. Locule nage. From 1804, the Haitian are suffering 2008. Things now get better. Be a foundation for people get better. If they don't have the money, then they don't get cooked. So they don't money. They shall take the money and put in at their pocket. And see the whole of them come on and run be a racket. And they get the people, man, them just can't take it. They will bust them gun for no rabbit. Young fella bust me this hand no play. Now the team on your love, I remember when they come down my day. Boy, go tell my cote nouye. Cote copla, America, man, no cote pla. I am a Haitian living in America. Me take a look at Haiti. See my people are suffering. They never give, have a still a chance to make it better. Locule nage, mes amis. I am a Haitian living in America. Take a look at Haiti. My people are suffering. Never give, have a still a chance to make it better. Locule nage. When you lay a Haiti, when we do, tell me when you went to your staff, but then you see back at your papa.
Yeah, that was a song by an artist named Biga Haitian. And the song is I Am a Haitian, and the album is Sak Passé.
Yes, and we have a caller on the line, and we're going to take that call. And let me unmute this person. Hello, and welcome to Talking Feather Radio. Hello, caller. Welcome to Talking Feather Radio. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Interesting topic of conversation to bring to light the plight of the Haitian people. But, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm a West Indian, and sometimes, yeah, we demagogue other nations, right? But for me personally, I have to beat up CARICOM. I have to beat up the Caribbean community also, okay? I have to beat up the Dominican Republic and different things, and France and Spain. And what happened, I think, with the United States, you know, I have to beat up our people for the simple reason that they don't understand the history and, you know, of our history, our culture, and our tradition, right? And the plight that our people take from Africa through the Caribbean into these United States of America, right? And that's one thing we have to bring alive. We have to teach people here, right, about our history, right, and what the Haitian people have done to help the United States fight a war and so on and so forth. And those things, you know, when a people don't know, right, they don't identify with, and that's what we see going on. You know, I've been living in the Caribbean for a long time before I came up here, and those are part of the history that we teach. And the reason why I said I have to beat up CARICOM, because Guyana, Barbados, Trinidad, Jamaica, all these islands, and Haiti is part of CARICOM.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying? So before, you know, yes, we can beat up the United States, we can beat up everybody else, but those islands also have to take an active part, right, in bringing to light the problems and helping the Haitians.
Let me ask you specifically, do you feel that CARICOM as an organization is not operating in some sort of unity that can bring strength to that part and to each other's, these nations? Are they too divided? Are they too focused on their own personal interests to say, if they could do something different, what should that difference be, and how would that benefit countries like Haiti and other indigenous people?
Well, you know, the biggest thing that I advocate, and Eric Williams advocate, the Prime Minister of Trinidad a long, long time ago, is to open up the Caribbean Basin for free trade. Okay? You know, you have to have a passport to get into every island, the EC countries and everybody else, right? My thing is, Haiti is part of CARICOM. There's no doubt about it. And before this earthquake, right, the Prime Minister was supposed to be taking over, you know, they serve a certain number of years to control that whole thing. But what needs to happen is whoever the Secretary General of CARICOM is, they need to sit up here and push Spain and push France and push the United States of America as one Caribbean without sitting up in here and isolating Haiti. Because if you remember, we got to go back and talk about Hispaniola and how, you know, and Dominican Republic plays a large part of it. You understand what I'm saying?
And my
biggest problem is when a Haitian sit up here and go over to the Dominican Republic and cut cane and do the different things that needs to be done over there, when they have a baby born there, that baby is called in transit and then sent back on the other side. That's, you know, it's foolishness. You know, once a baby is born in the soil, right, they at a certain age, they have to choose, right? And at one time, if you look at the Dominican Republic passport, it was almost white. You know, your color was white.
Yes.
And they have a lot of Haitian blood there.
Yes. Thank you for your comment. And I'm going to keep you on the line but mute you and let Paul Pumphrey, our special guest, comment, okay?
Thank you
for calling.
Yes, you put out some very good points. One of the things I think we also need to understand is that the United States and Europe, meaning France and Great Britain, are very much, and Canada as well, let's not forget Canada, are very much involved with manipulations of all the different governments within the CARICOM. And that's part of the problem. And wherein the problems in most of these countries are not just created from inside these countries, but also many of the problems are created from outside those countries. It's going to take the people inside those countries to be organized, as well as those of us on the outside to organize as well and give support to these grassroots organizations on the ground, in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, in Dominica, in Jamaica, in Grenada, Trinidad, and so on and so on, that we must recognize that we have a role to play in solidarity work, because after all, it is U.S. tax dollars. Good example is the situation right now in Haiti with the earthquake. You have over one-third of the money that Barack Hussein, President Obama, claimed to be sending down to help out the people in Haiti go directly to the U.S. military. Now, how is it that Marines are supposed to be that useful in helping people in an earthquake situation?
Because it's
clear that they're not getting food to where the people need the food. They're not getting tents where people need shelter. They're not getting water where people need water. They're not purifying water. And so when you deal with the people on the ground in Port-au-Prince right now, many of them are getting sick, because they're forced to drink contaminated water. And, in fact, they may go as long as 3 or 4 days without getting any food.
Yes, I'm
sorry?
No, I was just commenting on your point, Paul Pumphrey, that there was a report that was just released that said of every aid dollar hundreds of millions of dollars that are poured into Haiti, every aid dollar that's going in there, 1 cent on every dollar is getting to actual Haitians on the ground. And the rest of it is going to, a large part of it is going to the Defense Department. And one of the main actors that's been pointed out in America's, quote, humanitarian operation is the Defense Department and the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development and the thousands of NGOs that are on the ground.
You know, to me, this is basically genocidal practices under the guise of helping people. I mean, it's just, they're just allowing people to get sick and die.
Paul, I want to ask you, not to lose a point that you were making, but I want you to also comment on one of the cries for help from Haiti. We are seeing people being interviewed, and they're saying, bring back Aristide. Bring back Aristide. This would help unite the country at a time of this low point of devastation. What comment, if any, do you have about Aristide as being a savior, so to speak, for Haiti, or not so?
I would assume that you probably could find as many people saying bring back Aristide as you got people saying bring back Baby Doc, as you do hear some people say that. But it's nowhere near, even close to being 1/10 of the population calling for the return of either one of those leaders that were there previously. But you will find that their supporters, whether they're being supporters because they're financially connected or because they just happen to like them one way or another, will consistently try to make a case that the problems of Haiti could be resolved better if either one of those leaders come back, Baby Doc or Aristide. I think it's very clear that one of the confusion, there's been a lot of confusion about what went on with the Aristide era inside of Haiti, and I think I would like to try to attempt to really give a little bit of update or history as to what really happened from 1990, or I'll even go back earlier than that, from, say, 1988 up to now, as to Jean-Bertrand Aristide. When he was a priest, he clearly had a church in the area of Port-au-Prince near the called City Soleil, and he had a large constituency in the poor communities, some communities of Port-au-Prince. And by far, he is very, very good. He's a very, very good orator. He's one of the best presenters I've ever seen. I mean, this guy can get in front of a crowd that may be halfway asleep and have them standing on top of their seats, jumping up and down and screaming and hollering and cheering him on in a matter of 3 minutes of presenting his point of view. So he's a very good presenter. And this popularity, after his church was burned to the ground, continued because he had a radio show in Port-au-Prince that people listened to every week. And this radio show, he took that opportunity to denounce Baby Doc. And after he left, the military government to follow them. So he was popular from his speeches. You had the different grassroots movements who had put so much pressure on the Duvalier regime, forcing the United States to become fearful that if they did not remove Duvalier, which was a central point on which people could agree upon to oppose the government, that if they did not remove them, that they feared that the people of Haiti would take over the Duvalier government and the United States would lose all kinds of control that they would have. Had the Duvalier government or the military stayed in power. So in the 1986, I believe it was, the United States in 87, the United States came into Haiti, told Baby Doc his days of being president for life was over and that he would have to leave with his family and get on a plane, a U.S. military plane, and be flown to France. Now, Baby Doc didn't want to go. Clearly, his government had been a government that had been in the back pocket of the United States, and so it wasn't because the United States was hostile to him because he pretty much cooperated with whatever they wanted him to do. But they saw, the U.S. government saw, that there was a potential that they would lose control over the government if he stayed there any longer. So they removed him. And Aristide continued to make fine brimstone speeches about not only Baby Doc after he left, but also about the military government that took over after the United States removed Baby Doc. And then as they moved it towards an election, the many different grassroots organizations throughout the country decided to form a coalition, and in that coalition create a coalitional party. The name of that party was called the Lavalas Party. Now, the English translation for the word Lavalas is the word we know here in the United States is avalanche. And my first response was, what would Haiti know about an avalanche? But I come to find out that that was really a word that was referred to when they had heavy rainstorms because of deforestation of many of the mountains. You would have a situation where the soil would lose connection and would slide down the hill into a huge mudslide. And that mudslide functioned very much similar to what an avalanche would look like on a mountain full of snow. And that's where the word Lavalas came from. Anyway, as the different groups got together for the first time, many of them never had worked together. They knew of each other, but they had never worked together because of the repression. They kept a certain amount of secrecy amongst themselves and within themselves. And so now that they're working together, the decision was made that none of the leaders of the different groups should take the lead as being the presidential candidate for Lavalas. So the decision was made to pick a candidate that did not have a grassroots movement. That way, that candidate would not, by being the presidential candidate, would not have an advantage over his movement over the rest of the organizations. And the different grassroots movements ran candidates under Lavalas' party for the House of Deputies as well as for the Senate. And so that person that was chosen to be the presidential candidate was John Bertrand Aristide. Now, as I said, he was very well known around Port-au-Prince because of his radio show. But he wasn't as well known in many areas of Haiti simply because the radio show didn't go out into the hills, many of the hills from away from Port-au-Prince, one. Two, most people did not have a TV, so they didn't see him from TV. And they didn't have electricity in many places in the countryside. And many of them could not read. And so it gave a great advantage to the grassroots movements because they're the ones that met with people one-on-one or in small groups or large groups. And so they didn't have to depend on the media to talk to large numbers of people. On the other hand, the Madison Avenue style of elections that U.S. often employs around the world didn't work in Haiti because, in fact, of the points I brought up before, the inability of many people to read and the fact that in the countryside many people didn't even have electricity, so they didn't have a radio or TV. So to have a billboard or radio ads or TV ads really didn't serve much purpose because most people didn't see it, or if they did see it, they couldn't understand it. This advantage allowed for the Lavalas party to win an a landslide victory in 1990, so that when the election, when it's time for inauguration in 1991, President Aristide was named as the first elected president after so many years of dictatorship. Now, again, many people assumed that because he was elected president that, in fact, he was the leader of most of these grassroots movements, which he was not. But one of the problems, almost from the very beginning, was that the understanding that the movements had with President Aristide was that once he got in office, he would draw from the different organizations to make his cabinet. But President Aristide chose something different. Many of the leaders that he brought into his cabinet were people who had nothing to do with the grassroots organization, which created a little bit of tension between the different organizations and President Aristide. But as they moved forward, they had the grassroots movements had an agenda that they wanted to implement, land reform, free education, a number of things along that line. And President Aristide seemed to be kind of dragging his feet as he was making proposals for legislation for the country. In response to that, the United States took advantage of the little friction that was happening between different organizations in the Lavalas Coalition and President Aristide to get the generals who were under their payroll to create a military coup in September of 1991. Now, the general who was actually assigned to kill President Aristide, when he went to get President Aristide, this gentleman seemed to respect the Haitian Constitution. And rather than kill President Aristide, he actually escorted President Aristide to the Venezuelan embassy, which the Venezuelan government immediately gave him asylum. And then the general reported back to the presidential palace, in which Cedras, who was the head of the military coup, had gave an order to have that general executed. And in fact, he was executed right there on the spot inside the palace grounds. Now, in New York, after being made aware of the coup d'état, the Haitian ambassador called for an immediate Security Council meeting, in which the United States and the other permanent members of the council met. And a resolution was brought together that said that President Aristide would be considered the only legitimate spokesperson for the government of Haiti. The United States, not realizing that President Aristide was not dead, voted in favor of that resolution. Only to find out a couple of hours later that President Aristide not only was alive, but was on his way on a plane down to Venezuela. Now the United States is in a little dilemma. As President Aristide began to apply to get a visa to come to the United States, but the United States was blocking the visa. And this was under the first President Bush. As this took place, the ambassador from Haiti went before the General Assembly and requested a special meeting on Haiti, which the General Assembly agreed to by a majority vote. And then they invited President Aristide to be the keynote speaker. Now the United States is brought up with a kind of a dilemma where they're asking permission for President Aristide to come into the country, and the State Department finally gave in and gave the visa for President Aristide to come from Venezuela to New York to give the speech. Once he came into the United States, he stayed here, moved into Washington, D.C., and began to look at mapping out a strategy of lobbying to change and get rid of the old military coup. When that happened, you had a situation where President Aristide also began to look at a couple of other things. One of the things that has been an apple in the eye of the United States government is that the Haitian government owns its telephone company, Teleco. And between the long-distance phone calls from the Haitian community and the business community from here to Haiti and the collect calls coming from Haiti to the United States, there's collected about $30 or $40 million a month from those phone calls at 23 cents a minute to be sent back down to the government of Haiti. And President Aristide organized some lawyers to go to court to insist that since he was the only legitimate spokesperson, that that money not be sent to the military coup leaders in Port-au-Prince, but in fact that money stayed here in the United States with his provisional government, and he won. This created now more pressure on the government of Haiti because they no longer were getting the $30 and $40 million that they had gotten before because of the money coming from long-distance phone calls. This moved forward in a situation where President Aristide began, and other people began to start talking about the issues of Haiti, and it became a popular kind of a movement being built in the United States, putting pressure on the Clinton administration to, in fact, see that President Aristide and the Lavalas Party would be put back into power inside of Haiti. Another thing happened was that the UN passed a resolution calling for an economic embargo on Haiti, and many of the U.S. factories that were there solely pretty much to make products to be sold back into the United States were caught in the middle of the embargo and were not able to sell those products back into the United States. They began to put pressure on President Clinton also, insisting that President Clinton get rid of the embargo so that they could sell more of their products back into the U.S. This led to a situation where Clinton finally succumbed and called for negotiations up in New York at Governor's Island between Aristide and representatives from the military government. The result of that came up with a program where the United States would escort Aristide back into the country, but before that, they would take the president, the military president of Haiti, and his top leaders, and moved them away from Haiti. In fact, they took them down to Panama. So here's the second example of where the U.S. military came in and took leaders of Haiti away from power, even though those leaders was doing what the United States government wanted them to do. because the issue was that they wanted to get rid of the embargo, and so but those leaders staying in power was working more against the interests of what the president and the government of the United States wanted than it would have been to keep them in power. So they bring Aristide back into power in about October of 1994. When he gets back, Aristide immediately began to push for some of the things that he had agreed with Clinton. One was the privatization of the phone company. And when he pushed for that, people in the countrywide became very upset and began to protest and challenge that idea of selling Telco. But what Aristide's next move was that at that point there were no private cell phone companies in Haiti.
Paul, we only have about 9 minutes left. I just wanted to remind you of the time.
Okay, let me slip through that. Anyway, he privatized the cell phone companies. As he privatized the cell phone companies that were to be created, the first one that was created and the largest one was created was called Comcel, in which Aristide ended up being part owner of, and also Hillary Rodham Clinton's brother became the other part owner of that cell phone company. And then the second cell phone company was called Itel, in which Aristide's family ended up becoming 10% ownership of that one as well. And so you had this situation where it appeared that Aristide, when he came back, was kind of aligning himself with the international business community over the national business community as well as the local people in the country. As he left office in February of 1996, the relationship between Aristide and the grassroots movements that made up a lot of the laws were very strained. By September, October of 1996, Aristide started a new political party, which was known as the Family of Lava Loss. And that's the same party that people today refer to as Lava Loss, but it was not the same party that brought him to power in 1990 that was run by the grassroots organization. When he made this move, he then stepped on the toes for Bill Clinton because he then realigned himself, not with the grassroots movements, but with the national business interests of Haiti. And Bill Clinton then became angry, and he cut off all aid going to Haiti, which then made Aristide have to figure out another strategy of how to get that aid back, in which he worked closely with the Congressional Black Caucus. He worked closely with TransAfrica. In fact, he hired Randall Robinson's wife to become the chief lobbyist for the government of Haiti, in which she was making about $30,000 a month plus expenses. This then moved forward until December of 2000, when the Supreme Court of the United States awarded the presidency to George W. Bush. Now Aristide recognized that he, no matter how much influence he had with the Democratic Party and the Congressional Black Caucus, it was not going to go very far with the majority-run Senate and House of Representatives in Haiti. So he switched again, and he began to align himself with the Bush administration. And one of the first things that he began to do with the Bush administration was to set up a new tax-free enterprise zone. This is a part of the country in which only foreign factories can come into, in which the government of Haiti would have to build the buildings for the factory, build the electrical power plant, build the loading docks for the ships to come in and go out on the expense of the government. And all the foreign companies had to do was move their equipment in and their raw materials to make their products and take advantage of the cheap labor in Haiti. And he built that enterprise zone up at the northeast corner of Haiti, right next to the Dominican border and the northern part shore of Haiti. Now, this very much angered many of the Haitians because the people who had the land that this enterprise zone was built on were not notified even in advance before their mango trees and stuff were bulldozed down. This created even more animosity between the poor and Aristide. But it also got the national business interests of Haiti angry with Aristide, because here now Aristide is aligning himself with the international business interests, which has had a history of pushing the national business people to the side when they come in and take over. And so now you have the poor organizing against Aristide, along with the national business interests organizing against Aristide. And that combination ended up into two different organizations. One was called Group 184, and the other one was called Convergence. As these organizations began to demand that Aristide leave, the momentum began to grow and grow and grow until the Bush administration, which was split because people like Colin Powell were saying we should stick with Aristide, and people like Noriega, who was working in the State Department, were saying, no, he had to go. You couldn't trust him. At any rate, the result was, come around February of 2004, the decision was made by the Bush administration to take Aristide out of the country, the same way Baby Doc was taken out of the country, the same way the military coup leaders were taken out of the country. And he was taken to the Central African Republic, in which he was made a guest at the presidential palace of the Central African Republic. Now I ask the audience to think about it. If Aristide was an enemy of the United States and the Bush administration, do you really believe he would be taken and left as a guest in a presidential palace, even though he may not want to be there? Or do you think he would have been in jail, or they would have killed him like they did Saddam Hussein, Milosevic, or Noriega out of Panama? The second question.
Yes, go ahead. Go right ahead.
The second question I asked the audience to answer is that Aristide had a private security company, which were U.S. mercenaries, and the name of that company was called the Steele Foundation. And the Steele Foundation had contracts with the Department of Defense and the CIA at the same time they were protecting Aristide. And they were with Aristide all the way up to the point in which Aristide was taken to the Central African Republic. Now, do you really believe George Bush will be given contracts through the DOD, Department of Defense, and the CIA to a company that was protecting someone he saw as his enemy? I really don't think so.
That raises some very interesting questions, and we're going to have to leave it. We only have about 2 minutes left. We're going to have to leave it with our listening audience to connect those dots and to pull this all together. I wish we had scheduled for a little bit more time so we could have fully explored this. You know, on a closing note, Paul, the parallels, very quickly in a minute, the Haiti is a microcosm of what has happened to indigenous countries. Are there any parallels you see between Haiti and the plight and the atrocities that are being visited upon indigenous people throughout the globe?
Very many, very many. In fact, one must be clear that the United States was a country, well, this land that we live on right now was once owned and occupied by our brothers and sisters of the Native American. And in fact, the United States imposed itself onto them, and then imposed himself onto them, took full advantage of them, and pretty much went through an extermination process or policy very similar to what they've done in many countries around the world, including Haiti today. And
yes.
So there are many parallels wherein the people who actually possessed the wealth and, in fact, was willing to even share it with other people were taken advantage of and abused in the process, and that many of the agreements that the United States made with our brothers and sisters, which were called treaties, were constantly and are still being violated today.
Yes, we need to pay attention to that, Paul, and we are going to have to leave it right there. The United States and other Western countries continue to violate the rights of indigenous people globally. Haiti is a microcosm. Haiti is a window through which we can see many parallels. Paul, we want to thank you so much for joining us for this program on Haiti, Robbed, Not Poor, and we look forward to having you back on Talking Feather Radio.
And I thank you for the opportunity to share my information with you.
All right. Be well, and we will be getting in touch with you soon.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, folks, thank you for joining us. We're going to go out with some indigenous music from Haiti. Thank you for being with us today.
Bye.